Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm co-producer Nancy Roth. We're continuing with the memoir, How to Be a Sister, a love story with a twist of autism, read by the author, Eileen Garvin.
Chapter 9. What's next, Margaret? If you cannot participate in sports or games with grace and good temper, you should not participate at all. Cursing your luck, excusing, complaining, and protesting against unfairness won't get you anywhere. On Being a Good Sport, Emily Post's Etiquette. On a perfect June morning, I stood in the sunlight in my front yard, hose in hand, watering the berm I'd recently planted on the west side of my lawn. Since I'd moved to Oregon, gardening had given me a sense of pleasure I never knew was possible. How satisfying to plan, to clear a space, to plant small, delicate seedlings. To begin, what a surprise to watch these small green shoots grow and blossom, even thrive. I was happy I hadn't given up on gardening after my first attempt, which amounted to nothing short of seedling slaughter. I was living in New Mexico at the time, and it had never occurred to me that soil and climate had much to do with the mass destruction that had followed my first attempts. I'd always thought it was me. I'd been thinking about beginnings a lot, not so much first attempts as much as second tries and second chances. I'd never been much good at sticking with something unless it was easy at first. I was used to things coming easily, academics, sports, music, or not at all. Now, here I was in my fourth decade, starting over with all kinds of things, activities and work and relationships, inconceivable as that might have seemed just a few years ago. I was thinking about all of this as I moved my hose across the berm, spraying across the hopeful faces of blue fescue, bright yarrow, thready Carl Forster grass, lavender. I was cheered inexplicably by the wind stirring the diminutive branches of the miniature tabletop pine I'd planted for Brendan. I'd spent hours clearing the weeds from this spot, working the soil, choosing the plants, plotting the layout, laying the weed cloth, shoveling mulch. And all of a sudden, there it was, just like I pictured it would be. How satisfying and how unusual. To date, my life had not been as tidy as this little plot of land. I had grown up with the dynamics of autism, so I was used to surprises, but I was unaccustomed to the happy ending. I was hardwired for the quirky finale, the crisis, and the climax of the unforeseen and the unmanageable. Even though I hadn't lived with my sister for almost 20 years, when it came to Margaret, I always expected the worst. That gloomy outlook had somehow bled over into my daily life years ago, giving me an incredible imagination for disaster. First out of habit, and then out of talent, I'd spent a lot of time imagining things going terribly wrong, things that have never actually happened. Car accidents, fires, fistfights, general crime and mayhem. Every time Brendan was 5 minutes late, I was sure the state patrol was pulling his car out of the icy slough. When the cat wouldn't come in at night, it was a rabid raccoon that got her. When a plane hit a patch of turbulence, it was all I could do not to clutch the hand of the stranger sitting next to me and tell her about the things I hold dearest in this life. I'd been trying to give up this habit. It just wasn't very restful. Plus, the rational side of me knew that there really are people who live in crisis day in and day out, and that I should count my blessings that I was no longer one of them. As I watered my colorful garden, I thought about a pending trip home to see my sister and admitted to myself how nervous I was about the things I couldn't predict. I'd put this trip off month after month without a good reason, but I was pretty sure it was mostly because I didn't know what would happen when I got there. I knew what might happen. I could drive 300 miles to her house, just have her slam the door in my face. This hadn't happened for a long time, but it was still a very real possibility. It had been more than 6 months since I'd last seen Margaret and gone hiking with her. At first, the winter kept me away. Icy roads climbing out of the Columbia River Gorge and up into the desert plains of eastern Washington were too much for my two-wheel drive and my nerves. But the snow had melted a long time ago, and now what was keeping me was just the uncertainty. 6 months is a long time to go without seeing someone. And yet with Margaret, it might seem the same as 6 days or 6 years. I didn't know what she thought about time. For her, 5 minutes could seem like an eternity when she had to wait. And yet, she might greet me after several months as if she had just seen me the day before. Because her communication skills were so limited, we didn't correspond, at least not in the normal way. I'd send a postcard every now and then. Sometimes I'd call and talk to a staff member about how she was doing. At the end of our conversation, they'd hand the phone to Margaret, who usually said hello before hanging up on me. As a result, there were large drifts of silence between our visits. But it wasn't like we would have months of catching up to do, either. Margaret didn't talk much, so I anticipated that when I did see her, there would be a lot of quiet, maybe some sudden singing or loud commentary, or whispering behind her cupped hand. If I wanted to know how she'd been, I had to ask her caregivers, the people who were paid to make sure she ate 3 meals a day, took a shower, brushed her teeth, got to swimming practice, and left the locker room with her swimsuit turned around the right way. These people were almost complete strangers to me, and yet they inhabited my sister's daily life and created the stability she needed, just as my family used to. If I asked Margaret how she'd been, she wouldn't be able to tell me. She wouldn't be able to ask me either. I doubted she even knew what any of that meant in the context we normally ask each other these kinds of questions. Tell me what you've been thinking and feeling. How are your old wounds? Do you have any new ones? What about your joys? So we wouldn't have any long conversation like some sisters might. We would just have the day. A car ride, a hike, lunch, the drive home. Things we both enjoy. We'd just have those few hours to spend together, mostly in silence, and maybe that was enough. At the time, I had been very conscious of her absence in my life. I didn't miss the bad times, the years of family tension and violent outbursts, years that I had spent feeling somehow simultaneously responsible and resentful, ineffective and unappreciated. Countless times, Margaret had worked herself into a rage or a panic over some nameless thing she couldn't communicate, and there was absolutely nothing to be done about it but wait it out, like one waits for a cyclone to pass. But we struggled against it anyway, trying to calm her down, trying to get her to stop throwing herself on the floor, against walls, trying to tame the screaming with our own quiet words, with our own anger and tears of impotence. Those years were like battle, and they cast a shadow far into our 20s and 30s. Walking on the beach in Mexico at Christmas, my brother Mike told me about the emotional turbulence a friend of his was going through. "Yes," I said, "I've been depressed before, too. It was really, really hard." Mike nodded. "But it only lasted about 20 years, I said, and then we both just howled. Perhaps it had taken this long for the quiet to take hold, for the dust to settle, for me to feel Margaret's absence in my life. I missed my sister. I felt the lack of her very physical presence. I missed her familiar bulk, the feel of her thin hand in mine when she was happy, the sound of her joyful laugh, her real beautiful smile, not the fake one she saved for the camera. If I closed my eyes, I saw Margaret in a red and white striped shirt and blue jeans with an elastic waistband, white tennis shoes, her teenage uniform. She had a bob and bangs, like me, our eternal haircut. I breathed in this image and smelled spaghetti noodles, one of her favorite foods. She often spilled food on herself from eating too quickly. This wasn't an unpleasant smell, although I was often embarrassed for her. But I got used to the stains on the front of her shirts, got used to helping my mother pick out Margaret-colored clothes that didn't show the food stains as prominently. And later, when I was in graduate school and my friend Anne gestured to her own large breasts and referred to them as the crumb shelf, I thought of my well-endowed sister and laughed. Maybe Margaret wasn't so strange after all. When we were children, Margaret smelled like flowers, moist and powdered after her nighttime bath. She'd swoop around the bedroom in her long cotton nightgown and bare feet. She'd race laughing up the stairs, the family dog yipping with excitement and nipping at her hem as she shouted, "I be the winner!" She'd collapse in hilarity on her twin bed in the room we shared. When I was in college and we were in our 20s, she was still doing this. These times were better than the bad times, the times when her wailing could last for hours, drawing the neighbors and even the police to our door. I could remember the feel of her skinny arms wrapped around me as she crushed me into her big, soft belly, cackling at some joke of her own making. Margaret would hug me so hard she'd pull me off my feet. She would also reach around and yank me up by the neck as if I were weightless. But Margaret hadn't hugged me like that in years. Nor had she spanked me, pinched me, whacked me on top of the head, or spit on me like she used to. When I was home, I no longer walked around the kitchen with my ass to the wall, forever on defense against some silent but inevitable attack. When she was being her noisy self, our father called her Thunderfoot, and yet when she wanted to sneak up on one of us, she had the stealth of a Jedi Knight. But not anymore. The minutes and hours and days we'd spent trying to get her to behave, to stop doing the things we didn't want her to do, were piled up in a closet of our past, gathering dust like her old records in my parents' basement. It was all meaningless now, though at the time it seemed like scolding her and trying to redirect her behavior was all we did. Trying to be reasonable myself, I might say, "Please don't hit me, Margaret. That hurts when you do that, and I know you have good manners." Or, in a less composed moment, I might clutch my head and say something like, pause. "God damn it, Margaret, don't hit me!" She'd just laugh and parrot back, "You don't hit me, ha ha ha!" And then she'd raise her hand to pretend like she was going to do it again, and then laugh some more, and run away. Sometimes she tried to behave. I could tell she was trying. And we really tried to think through how to help her understand what we were asking of her. As a teenager, Mike once sat at the table calmly explaining to Margaret why it just isn't nice to spit on people, especially to spit your dinner on them when they are eating their dinner. The spitting phase was just bugging the shit out of everybody, and he was trying to make her understand. Margaret sat there and appeared to be listening to our brother like a totally reasonable person. She put on a serious face, said, "Okay, Mike," and nodded as though she agreed with him completely that it was a really good idea if she used her polite table manners from now on. Then she took a big gulp of her soda, held it in her cheeks, and erupted in laughter, showering Mike with sugary drink. Mike just closed his eyes, wiped his face with his t-shirt, and left the table without a word. Once during the spitting phase, he and our brother Larry tried another tactic, spraying their own drinks back in her face. She thought that was just hilarious. The three of them sat there at the kitchen table, our own Trevi fountain, spraying soda and juice high in the air and across the room and hooting with laughter. That's pretty much how we handled things for 30 years or so. Try this, then that, then something else. This method of instruction was exhausting for us kids and often seemed more than useless. Margaret appeared to stop doing things only when she felt like it. Just when we gave up trying to make her stop, she dropped some behavior that we'd been trying to break her of for months or years, like pouring the milk down the sink, like spitting down the front of her shirt on purpose and wiping it up with her finger, like turning her music up really loud at certain points on the record so we all shouted, "Turn it down, Margaret!" Like talking to herself, like spanking the house guests. Why would I miss this kind of behavior? Because it was a part of me and because it was all I had. This was how I knew my sister. This gigantic mass of predictably destructive behavior, irrational, unpredictable motivation, and enormous affection. Growing up around Margaret, I always felt like things were about to spin out of control, and I never knew quite how to handle whatever happened next, but I was used to it. I had a recurring dream when we were younger. I was driving in a car down a treacherous, twisting road in the dark. It was icy, and I wanted to slow down, but when I pushed the brakes, nothing happened. Then I realized I was sitting on the passenger side. I didn't see my sister much anymore. There's the old saying, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. It wasn't that simple. It was more like, you hate Jell-O, and then they take away the Jell-O, and you still don't like Jell-O, but you miss having dessert, so it turns out that Jell-O was better than no dessert at all. The loss I felt was partly just life taking its course. As an adult, I'd moved and traveled as I'd had the liberty and facility to do. My sister hadn't done those things, because she couldn't. She'd stayed in the same place, and we only saw each other when I returned to my childhood home. There was another reason I'd seen her less. A couple of summers before, I'd told my parents I would rather see Margaret alone when I came to visit instead of seeing her at the family lake cabin. Translation: don't invite Margaret. My sister's behavior at family gatherings had become unbearable to me. Our family's response to her behavior had become even more unbearable. As my visits grew ever briefer in adulthood, they remained violently colored with the dramatic outbursts from Margaret and the consequential fractionalization of the family as we failed, collectively and separately, to cope. And unlike when we were children, there was no time in between these intense sessions to enjoy the good stuff. I'd returned to wherever I was living at the time, completely drained. I'd get migraines on the plane, pulled muscles in my neck and back. I'd go back to work feeling exhausted, feeling like I hadn't really been on vacation. I don't know how Margaret felt, but I'd be willing to bet she was worn out too. So, she wasn't invited. The rest of us gathered at the cabin, and these visits were quieter and calmer than we'd ever experienced before as a family. And when I saw Margaret separately on my visits home, she was like a person transformed. I'd pick her up at her house for lunch or coffee, and she was quiet. Watchful. She always seemed glad to see me. We had what you might call normal times together, and yet I felt somehow that I'd lost something. We never discussed this issue as a family, but then we were never a family that was prone to discuss much. We were better at silent brooding or sudden fits of temper that went unresolved. I'm pretty sure, though, that my parents did not agree with me that things were better this way, because that's what I kept telling myself. It was better this way, to draw boundaries for her and for me, to try to act like the adult I wanted to be instead of the child I had been. I wanted to change the parameters of our relationship as I had with our other grown siblings, albeit in a more mutual way. Pondering all of this, I moved my hose to the rose bushes in the front yard and aimed the roots to try and keep the water off the leaves. They'd been here when we moved in. 8 bushes, all in a tangle of thorns and weeds and broken shoots. I left them alone for the first year as we got settled into the house. In the spring, I gave them the pruning of the century, or at least their first pruning of this century. I'd spent hours hunkered down on my hands and knees, cutting back the dead wood, ripping out grass and weeds, whittling the crowded stalks down to a healthy few. I got my hair tangled in the branches and cut my arms on the thick thorns. When I'd finished, I stood back to look at what I'd done, and I felt a rush of panic. Although I felt I'd been careful in the choices I'd made, the plants just looked butchered to me. I wondered if they'd ever come back. But I waited and prayed and watered them, and now here they were, gorgeous, exploding with healthy growth and enormous blossoms. I felt vindicated, but mostly I just felt happy that they were alive. That was something I'd learned about the benefits of starting over, of trying again when I thought something was impossible. My drive to Spokane, Washington was just under 300 miles. That was 4.5 hours of straight driving, with a coffee stop for me and a pit stop for Dizzy the dog. It was 10 p.m. before I pulled up in front of my brother Larry's house. We visited for a while, and then I headed out to sleep in my camper van with the hound. I woke up the next morning in front of Larry's house, looking out on the mild suburban landscape of the town I was born in. I was parked about a mile from the house I grew up in. Ponderosa pines swayed overhead in the weak sunshine. I climbed out the side door of the VW and moved stiffly toward the house with hopeful thoughts of coffee. A neighbor appeared to be staring at me as I shuffled up the driveway and into the house, but I was probably just imagining things. I'd grown up thinking everyone was always staring at us. That's because they usually were. My sister's disorder overshadowed every major event in my life, from first communion and eighth grade graduation to my first day of college and my wedding. It's fair to say her autism loomed over me even at my birth. On my 27th birthday, I sat across the table from my mother with a question on the tip of my tongue. "What was happening in your life when you were 27?" I wanted to know. She was that same age when I was born. Her last child. I wanted to know what she'd been thinking about as I floated there within the curve of her belly. "What did you think about me?" I wanted to ask. "What did you say to me when it was just the two of us alone?" But I never got the chance to ask. My mother was deep in conversation with my friend as we waited for our dinner to come, and I heard her say, "Margaret was diagnosed with autism in fall of 1970. She was just 3 years old." I felt sucker punched. My mother never noticed. But to me, my story now went like this. My birthday is the anniversary of Margaret's autism. At Larry's, I waited until I was sufficiently caffeinated, and then I drove north on Washington Street, the north-south artery that divides Spokane in half. I passed through a revived downtown area, past Riverfront Park, the site of Expo 74. The bridge took me across the Spokane River and up the hill into the Gonzaga University District. We went to high school near here, all of us but Margaret. Two of my siblings went to the university, and Larry finished law school in this neighborhood. Ann and Larry got married here, and I learned how to do a beer bong. Mike had narrowly avoided wrecking the car here on more than one snowy morning as we headed to school. This neighborhood had always been a kind of proving ground for our family in one way or another. Even now, I half expected to see a younger version of my brother Larry speeding down Hamilton Boulevard with Mike in the passenger seat and me in the back with Vanessa McCray. By the time I pulled up in front of Margaret's house, it was about 10 a.m. I got halfway up the walk before the door banged open and revealed Margaret's large frame. "Hi, Eileen," she said to me. Here stood my big sister, smiling and happy to see me. What a relief. She was wearing the tan hiking pants I'd bought her the previous summer and a short-sleeved zip-neck top I'd picked out for her. When we'd gone on a hike the previous fall, she'd been dressed in linen pants and a long-sleeved shirt. Neither had held up well in the dusty heat. Today, Margaret was also sporting a raspberry fleece coat that matched the shirt. Her hair had been cut recently. She looked great, and she was smiling. Thank God. "Hi, Eileen," she said again, and embraced me, my big, soft sister. It was a quick hug, but it was a hug. Not the no-arm lean-in I'd had last fall, when she seemed less sure about wanting to go anywhere with me. That day, she would barely look at me and kept muttering under her breath, making weird faces and avoiding eye contact when we went to REI for some rainy day shopping. A young woman stepped out onto the porch and introduced herself. This was Alicia, the one who'd urged Margaret to call me. New to the staff, Alicia was Margaret's focus person, the staff member who was most tuned in to my sister's daily life and tried to help her do the things she wanted to do, find a job, go swimming, run errands. Alicia was smart, cute, and genuinely warm. "Margaret was so excited that you were coming this morning," she said. And later, when I asked how Margaret had been and what she'd been up to, Alicia filled me in. Margaret obviously liked her very much as she smiled and hugged Alicia goodbye before getting in the car. As I left, Alicia told me, "I just love Margaret." I wanted to believe her. I could see how my sister would love her back. I needed to believe that Margaret was living with people who really cared about her well-being, who saw her as a person, an individual. It was hard to believe because I'd met a lot of Alicias, kind young women and men, often students, who did this job well and eventually moved on to better-paying, easier careers. I wanted someone to stay and be there for Margaret always, like family. But how could I expect that of a complete stranger when I couldn't do it myself? And why was I still feeling guilty that I was not there taking care of Margaret? No one had ever asked me to, and I was certainly not qualified in either temperament or training. But I'd taken care of her when we were growing up, as a matter of course. I was her big little sister, but I still felt responsible for her as an adult, and I felt guilty. As much as I was trying to accept that it just wouldn't be good for either of us, the survivor's guilt was hard to put down. I'd gotten used to the feeling of carrying that guilt on my shoulder, the way our dad used to carry a case of beer down the dock to our boat. Margaret had now galloped down the walk to the van. Dizzy wagged her tail in greeting and got a gentle pat on the nose from my sister. We both climbed into the van. "Hi, Eileen," she said again, and gave the door a mighty slam. The van rocked from side to side as I remembered, again, that Margaret closes every door as if she's the Incredible Hulk. "Hi, Margs." I leaned across the gap between the seats to give her another hug, still struck by her physical presence. "You look so pretty," I said. "Who gave you that coat?" She looked down at it and rubbed the fleece with her finger. "Anne," she said confidently, meaning our older sister, which I doubted. "You want to go for a hike?" she asked me, but it wasn't really a question. What she really meant was, "I want to go for a hike." But I responded anyway, "Yes, I do," and I pulled out my notebook. We are an anxious people, we Garvins. On this day, I was anxious because it is my habit, and my sister was anxious because she has autism. Or maybe it had nothing to do with her autism. It was just the family quirk that made her disorder harder to bear. Whatever the case, for both of our sakes, I had made a list of everything we would do that day. Both Margaret and I have always been compulsive list makers. Margaret would fill an entire notebook with something that was on her mind, lists of words like lake or lunch or Mike. Ladders of words climbed up and down the lined pages. My day planner, less linear, always looked like a key piece of the plot line from the movie Memento. But I figured if I planned out our day and wrote everything down, we could both refer to it if either one of us started feeling nervous. I'd written Eileen and Margaret's list at the top. I handed the notepad to my sister and asked her to read it. She scanned the list and swept a slender finger under each item as she read it. Home, store, hike, lunch, shop, home, she ended with a flourish. Where are we now? Margaret looked out the window. Home. So what's next? She looked at the page. Store. Right, we're going to the store to buy some snacks for the hike. And so we did. Huckleberry's Natural Food Store was on the south side of town. I was a little nervous about this stop because the store was also on the way to my parents' house, and I didn't want Margaret to think that that was where we were going, or to insist on stopping by and derailing my plans for the day, but she didn't mention it as we flew up the hill and pulled into the parking lot at Huckleberry's. Margaret was out of the door almost before the van had stopped moving and halfway into the building when I caught up with her. I grabbed a basket, which I asked her to carry. Huckleberry's was crowded. Margaret charged through the late morning throng with purpose, as if she'd won a timed shopping spree. This is just how she moves. Mostly people didn't notice. Occasionally someone sensed her moving up behind and jumped out of the way, looking startled or irritated. I kept a stupid smile plastered to my face, as if this would somehow ameliorate any trouble. Hi, we're friendly, just a little weird. That's what my smile said. Luna bars, trail mix, apples, and water. With our items quickly gathered, Margaret banged our basket down on the counter. The cashier quickly shifted his gaze to me because my sister didn't make eye contact. But he was friendly, nonetheless. I paid, I said thank you, we left. What's next, Margaret? I asked my sister. Hike, she said. Now she was grinning. Interstate 90. It's one of the longest in the country, stretching from Seattle to the Midwest. For 30 years, my family had used about 30 miles of it to get back and forth from town to the lake, which was what we call Lake Coeur d'Alene. The section we'd always traveled took us from downtown Spokane to open land that used to look like country, cows grazing, the occasional horse, homey old farmhouses under the shade of tall willows. Any semblance of country between Spokane and Lake Coeur d'Alene had disappeared during the 1990s. First came the outlet malls, and then housing developments sprang up on the shoulders of hills like acne on a teenager. The traffic was now constant and thick. I wondered where all these people were going and where you might work if you lived out here. When I was a kid, the open space out here would lull me into a doze by the time we reached our marina. It was a beautiful transition time, taking us from our busy lives in town to the quiet tempo of lake life. All seven of us would pile into a Chevy van with cats and dogs and the birds in a birdcage and food for a week or more at a time. We'd drive to the marina, load the boat, and speed across the short stretch of water between the dock and our place, unload the boat, and then there we were. Our own line of sandy beach, our splinter-inducing dock, deep, cool water, and the quiet woods behind the house. Since 1973, this had been our gathering place, this secluded spot with no road. Anyone who came had to arrive by boat and stay after dark, a paradise or a prison, depending on your take. Often for me, that depended on what kind of mood my sister was in and what kind of reaction her actions incited in the rest of the family. As I mentioned, we'd had some wonderful times at the cabin without Margaret in the past couple of seasons. My father wrote me an email after the first experiment saying he'd never had a better time. He didn't mention the fact that my sister was not there, but the rest of us siblings had felt more relaxed because we weren't holding our collective breath all weekend. Maybe my dad felt that too. As for my sister Margaret, I truly believed that being out there with all of us made her unhappy, not when we were children, but when we were young adults. She never made it through a visit without completely melting down. And when she wasn't upset, she was withdrawn, listening to her music and rocking, trying to build a wall against the rest of us. On a normal Saturday in July, there might be 20 people in the place, all talking and laughing, playing music. How could this have been fun for Margaret? How could she not have a blow up? When I thought of it that way, it made sense to me that my sister was so calm, so quiet when I spent time alone with her. And I could believe during those hours that this was a good time, a period of transition into something new and better for all of us. Margaret and I rode along and felt the road move under the tires. Neither one of us said much, but it was an easy silence. Easier, anyway, than it had been in the past. As we neared the exit for the town of Coeur d'Alene, I got nervous. We would pass our marina on the way to the hike I'd chosen. Even though she said she wanted to go hiking, this could be disastrous, since disrupting Margaret's routine has always been a sure way of setting her off. I was picturing myself driving east on I-90 with my sister wailing and thrashing in the passenger seat as I tried to keep the van on the road. Pause. You're going to the lake! You're going to the lake! Pause. Over and over again. That's what I saw in my head. That's what I used to see all the time. My sister freaking out and inconsolable. And a driving hazard, I might add. But I was wrong again. We passed right by the exit to our marina, and Margaret simply turned her head to watch it go past.
You've been listening to How to Be a Sister, a love story with a twist of autism by Eileen Garvin, published in 2010 by the Experiment Publishing of New York, and read by the author. You can get more information on the author and the book on Google, Eileen Garvin, G-A-R-V-I-N. The Bookshelf is a production of Spokane Public Radio. Executive producer is Vern Windham. Thanks to our two fine technical editors, Ellie Hoggett and Caitlin Webster. They're from the Lewis and Clark PICI class. I'm producer Nancy Roth.